hope most of you know that I'm Seamus McAleer. I'm the president of the Ulster Medical Society, and we're here tonight for another in our series of evening lectures. We have people online as well as people in the room. In fact, this will be the last time this year we'll be able to have people in this room. From now on, the Trust are probably going to make us do it all virtual, so that'll be a pattern that we see from other parts, but so that's quite likely to happen. But tonight, we are blessed to be able to go ahead with a face-to-face lecture, and tonight is Professor Neil Kennedy. And Neil qualified in medicine in Manchester in 1990, so compared to me, he's a child. And he had regular training in paediatrics in the northwest of England, and then training in tropical medicine in the University of Liverpool. And in 1997, he moved to Malawi and worked in a rural hospital right through until 2002. He then came back to Northern Ireland and did some more training. I went to QUB as a senior lecturer in paediatrics in 2005. In 2008, he returned to Malawi to work in the College of Medicine, the only medical school in Malawi. He was head of paediatrics and then dean of medicine in 2015. In 2016, he returned to Queen's as a clinical senior lecturer. And then he became acting director of CME in 2017, just 8 months after returning to the UK. And importantly, he was put in just 1 month before a major GMC inspection, regional visit and inspection of the medical school. It went through reasonably well. He was appointed director of CMU and he had passed that test. And the Nuffield Chair of Child Health, that was again in March 2019. He continues to have an ongoing interest in global child health, and he leads undergraduate and postgraduate taught modules in QUB. As well as that, he has chosen to review and overhaul the curriculum. We've got the new C25 curriculum, which has been in place now, or started, launched in 2020 and working its way through. I think that's a very progressive, very modern curriculum with case-based learning and with progress testing for assessment. And I think it's given the medical school a bit of a lift, a bit of energising. But tonight, Neil's going to talk to us about a little bit of his past care, but medical education in Malawi. I'm going to be quite interested in that, Neil. So, Neil, you're very welcome. Thank you very much.
First of all, lovely to be here, and thanks, Seamus, for that introduction. Apologies, I'm not wearing a tie. I've just come straight from clinic, so... but it's lovely to be here tonight and nice to be able to talk to some people face to face and to whoever's online. As is my wont, I was putting this together too late, so I haven't come up with anything very exciting other than I was asking myself some questions. I thought, where, what, so I just called one where, two what's and two why's, and I'll answer those questions as we go through. So first of all, what about the where of medical education in Malawi? What's the context? Well, for me, the context started, as Seamus mentioned, in a small rural mission hospital in the north of Malawi called Mbangweni. The phrase "any" is a bit like "bally" in Northern Ireland. It's the same sort of idea. It means "place of." So there's lots of Ekwendeni and Chakachakeni, that sort of type thing. Lots of places ending in "any." And I was in Mbangweni, a really small rural area. It was around 150, 160 miles north of the capital, but the actual hospital was 20 miles away from a tarmac road. So we were down a dirt road for about 20 miles, very close to the Zambian border. And there, the only sort of real reliable means of communication we had with the outside world was a radio. We didn't have radio, regular telephone. We had one of these windy up devices that you wind up something and you plugged in randomly things into a hole in the front of you, and you hoped that somebody on the other end of it would answer, and they rarely did. So our communication was with by radio. It was a solar-powered hospital. We had no mains electricity, and our water all came from a borehole. What was it like there? It was wonderful. It was hard work, but it was a really, truly tremendous, life-changing experience. I was there with Sarah and the two kids, Ben and Grace. You can probably spot them. Ben was a few months old when we arrived in Malawi, and then Grace was born during our time there. The people group we worked with were the Ngoni, or the Nguni people. They are an offshoot of the Zulu nation who invaded Malawi about a couple of hundred years ago. In a way, it's a bit like Northern Ireland. They were colonized by people who caused all the trouble. So in the same way, the Nguni were in that part of Malawi. they didn't always wear clothes like that, but they did dress up for special occasions. And it was wonderful to sort of take part in events like that. I did all the sorts of things you would expect somebody to do in a mission hospital. I'd left paediatrics and I trained in paediatrics because I enjoyed it, but I was doing it because I always knew I wanted to work in Africa. And I actually thought at that time when I went there, I may never do anything else. This may be me for life, to work in a very sort of general role in a rural mission hospital. I was involved in primary health care. You know, I did sit under a tree and immunize 300 kids one day, that sort of thing. I got involved in shallow well production. We set up mobile clinics all over the place. But I was also then doing secondary health care in all the different disciplines. So that's me pretending to know how to do a cesarean section. When I came back from Malawi, I was doing my first ARCP. I think maybe, I don't know if Charlie, you were on the board. Anyway, so it was one of my ARCPs was on there, and you had to list your activities, you know, like how many lumbar punctures you'd done and things like this. So I'd done my lumbar punctures and my cannulas and this sort of stuff in children, how many intubations I'd done. I also listed my 200 cesarean sections, my 34 bowel repairs, and my 5 ruptured uterus repairs, which I think is unique in the world of paediatric training, all the different things I've done over the time. It was an amazing experience, and I really enjoyed it. But when I was there, a few years in, we began to meet medical students who had just started in the College of Medicine, which is in the south of Malawi. It had just got off the ground, and began to meet these people and realized that there was something really special about them. And I thought maybe I should be actually teaching rather than providing the work myself. At that time, there was only 20 students a year got into medicine for the entire country. There must have been something in the water around Mbangweni because 3 of them came from our area, and I got to know them well, and I was really impressed with them and with their compassion and with their commitment to medicine. So I went and spoke to folk in Blantyre, a big city now in the south of Malawi where the College of Medicine was, and asked them, you know, would you be interested? You know, I've done this. This is where I've done my training. I've worked in a mission hospital here. Would you be interested in somebody like me coming and working with you? And they said, yes, but you need to go back to the UK, finish up your consultant training, and if you can, get some medical education experience and then come back out again. So I thought that's a good plan. So that's what I did. So I went back here and trained, finished off my training here. I trained in England initially, but finished off my training here, and then was fortunate enough to get a senior lecturer's job in 2005. Which I carried on until 2008, but I always knew I was going to resign. So I resigned for the second time from the NHS in 2008, and then I went back to Malawi, and this time working for the College of Medicine in the south of Malawi in Blantyre. So Blantyre is a whole different world from Mbangweni. Blantyre is a city of 1 million people. It's an urban sprawl. That's a picture from one of the tops of the mountains. There are 3 or 4 mountains around it. It's an elevated area. It's about 1,000 meters elevation. And there's as you can see, maybe you can just see those little white dots. Those are the sprawls, the urban sprawls of very, very, very poor urban housing, such as it is there, with high levels of deprivation, high levels of urban deprivation, very poor sanitation, violence and other problems that goes on in African big cities. But also, you know, access to really nice supermarkets, electricity that worked at least 4 days a week, water that worked nearly all the time, which is pretty impressive. All of that sort of stuff, all of that sort of good stuff was there. Schools for our kids, all of that sort of thing. So that's what I did. And again, we found ourselves loving it. I didn't slum it. That's my house there on the left, as you see it. And that was a view from our garden looking up at our condi, and some people in this audience here have been sitting on that condi, and you know how pleasant it is to sit there and watch the sun go down. It was a lovely place to be with a nice garden around us. On the right there is 3 of the loves of my life, the main one obviously being the Land Rover, and the which I was very dearly had to leave behind me in Malawi. The children did come with me, but the Land Rover had to stay behind at the end, and it was just a joy driving a long wheel drive, a wheelbase Land Rover around Malawi for at least a day a week. And the other 4 days of the week, if you've ever driven a long wheelbase Land Rover, you know you're fixing it. The rest of the time, you could drive it. But I enjoyed it very much. And there I was working in the College of Medicine in the University of Malawi. We had a nice, big, white, shiny building where the undergraduate facilities were. The first couple of years, based biomedical sciences area was, and the library. But my clinical work and where my office was work-based was actually in the children's department in Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital, which is about 200 metres up the road, and is a zoo of a hospital. It's around sort of officially 1,500, 1,600 beds, but usually occupancy rates are of about 4,000 people in that hospital. Paediatric admissions alone would total about 500 children at any one time. We would have takes regularly of over 100 children a day in and out in the middle of the rainy season. So it's incredibly busy, full-on place. And as you can see, we start the radiologists very young in Malawi there. You've got the kids looking at their own chest x-ray. Probably nobody else was going to look at it. And it was an interesting place to work and to teach, and I'll come back to that. For those of you who may have known her, Bernie O'Hare is actually on this photo here. This is Bernie here. Bernie was a senior lecturer in the College of Medicine as well, and she's teaching a medical student. That's this chap. Case-based learning, I guess. He's seen a case on the ward, and he's reciting it to her and talking through with her about the case of kids on the ward. So that's part of the where. Some bigger pictures of the where. Well, Malawi is a very fast growing population. It's 18 million now. When I first arrived in Malawi, it was about 11.5 to 12 million. It's now 18. It's one of the fastest growing populations in Africa. It's a country about the size of England. So you might think, well, that's plenty of room. And it is, but everywhere is very small villages. It's about sort of 80% rural. 20% urban. So it means everywhere you go, there's small village after small village after small village, with people eking out an existence in subsistence farming. Life expectancy is increasing. It's now into the mid-60s. It was at the peak of the HIV pandemic down to about 37 at one point. So it's now up into the 60s. So there's been some improvement again. Very high maternal mortality ratio and HIV prevalence. This is slightly out of date. It's lower now than 92 per thousand. It's probably about sort of 80 or so. All the rest of the numbers basically tell you it's a poorer place, and it is. It is a very poor country. It's designated low income. Its total GDP, this is the, if you look at OECD figures, total GDP is $12 billion a year, and about 35% of that comes from overseas donors. Just to compare that, UK health spending alone is $280 billion a year. So Malawi has, you know, the UK, the NHS takes about 20 or something, 25 times as much resource as the whole of Malawi has for its entire economy in a year. 70% of people are below the poverty line. Moderate inflation now, it was much higher, and it's very agriculture dependent. People have these subsistence farms. The big farms are in tobacco, coffee and tea. Coffee and tea are still doing well. Tobacco is obviously on the way out. But you see pictures like this of people working in fields and kids working in fields frequently. If you're ever bored and want to have a good look at something, gets lots of data, Gapminder is a wonderful thing. You can create all sorts of lovely graphs for yourself. And this is a Gapminder picture of life expectancy on the y-axis versus income on the x-axis. And you can sort of see this general slope. The richer your country is, and in general, life expectancy goes up. But I think, I hope I can get this one to work. This is, get this thing you showed me, Stephen. Perfect, here we go. So I've managed to get some of these highlighted here. And I just want to show you how poor Malawi is first. This is Malawi here. It's about $1,000. Not many countries over here anymore. There's not many places poorer than Malawi in the world. There are a few. If you're not familiar with Gapminder, all the blue countries are from Africa. All the yellow ones are from Europe. All the red ones are from sort of Southeast Asia and Oceania. And then the green ones are in the Africa, in the Americas. the big circles, the bigger the circle, the bigger your country. So one of these is China, this is this one, and one of them is India. Sorry, it's India. This is India, and this one is China here. So you can see there's this general trend, the poorer your country, the worse your life expectancy will be. But just look where Malawi is. Although it is incredibly poor, look at how many other countries which are much richer have a life expectancy which is no better. Okay. This is Nigeria here, that's South Africa there. Malawi has bucked the trend in some ways of being an incredibly poor country, but actually pushing way above its weight. It should be down here somewhere, okay? It should be with these guys, with life expectancies in the low 50s. But it's at least as good as Nigeria, actually better than South Africa, and doing remarkably well in some areas. Still dreadful problems, but actually a sign in some ways of success in an incredibly poor country. And I saw that in my own practice lifetime. I had the privilege of seeing that in my own practice lifetime, of seeing this fantastic fall in under five mortality over the time I was in Malawi. So this is about the late 90s when I first arrived. Under five mortality was about 200 at that point. So one in four children wouldn't make their fifth birthday. Under five mortality in Malawi now is 46 per thousand. That's an astonishing fall. These are amazing numbers, and they've been seen in many countries, in particularly in Southeast and Central Africa. You know, Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, Malawi, Zambia have seen falls like this. It's unique almost in our history to see these fantastic falls. Why? Well, because of all of the public health spending and all of the public health. I'd like to think that the curve got a bit steeper when I arrived. But it's nothing to do with me, okay? And it's not much to do with doctors. It is to do with doctors advocating for the sorts of change that need to be had. So that's the where, that's the only where. Well, what about the why? Why did I want to get involved in medical education as opposed to medical provision? Well, because of this, and this is a slides taken from a Lancet series looking at health professionals for the new century. So these are these standard maps where the size of the country expands according to the particular factor which they're looking at. So the one up here is looking at numbers of medical, the population. Well, this is population. So you can see India and China are massive. Then look at burden of disease, and Africa stands out as the place in the planet with the biggest disease burden. Sub-Saharan Africa is the only region in the world where non-communicable disease is not the number one cause of death. It's coming up fast, but still infectious disease is still more a common cause of death in Sub-Saharan Africa than non-communicable disease. That's unique in the planet. So huge burden of disease, big population, but this is numbers of medical schools, and you can see all of a sudden it disappears. And then this is doctors or nurses, and it gets even worse. Okay, Malawi's in here. This is all South Africa, this bit. And Malawi, Zambia, Mozambique just shrinks away. It's got some of the worst numbers of doctors and nurses and midwives. You put in whatever type of cadre of medical staff you wish in there, and it is incredibly low. You think, okay, well, do doctors actually make a difference? Does it matter if you have some doctors around the place? Aren't doctors expensive, nasty people who make machines that go beep and don't want to sort of put money into wells and all of that sort of stuff? And there's a very good argument for that. And Monica, you could maybe make it later on for us, but there is some argument for that. But it's an association, maybe as much as causation. But there's clear evidence that the more money that countries spend on their doctors, it's a bit like the reverse of that curve where your health spending goes up like this and then it flattens off, you know, so it's the obverse of that. So the numbers of doctors are going, the x-axis here, the child mortality in this case, you can see that small increases actually produces big, big drops. Now, it doesn't produce it, but it's indicative of investment in your health system. That's what it's indicative of. It's another indication of health systems strengthening. You could put lots of things onto that y-axis, numbers of hospitals, access to medical treatment, tests, HIV tests. You get almost exactly the same shape of curve. It's about health systems strengthening. And every health system needs doctors. It needs nurses, it needs midwives, but it does need doctors. So doctors do make a difference. And for the planet, we've seen a huge increase in the number of hospital of medical schools in sub-Saharan Africa, really since the sort of mid and early 90s onwards, a big, big push in the number of schools. These data only go up to 2010. But even since then, there's been some further schools, most of them public, but you can see there's a little green box there about private medical schools, and private medical schools are coming on the scene in some countries as well. And that's obviously changing the demographic about who gets to go to those medical schools. The medical school in Malawi was very much a medical school of, like, literally some of the kids who came to it were literally in a mud hut with thatch on the roof. That's where they grew up. And as the country has changed and as it's become more urban and as private medical schools start, then you find that the demographic of your intake changes and you get the sort of issues we have with the social class one professionals entering into medicine and the poor kept away. But medical school growth is happening because it's important as part of health system strengthening. And Malawi has seen that too. This is some numbers just really. The College of Medicine began in 91. These were its sort of 25-year birthdays. Well, how did the country progress over that time? It did start to output doctors, and with the ratio that in Malawi in 1991, there was one doctor per 100,000 people. By 2005, it had got to two doctors per 100,000 people. 2015, three doctors per 100,000 people, a 300% increase. Over that time. That's a bigger increase than we've had in terms of percentages, but remember that's equivalent of 60 doctors for all of Northern Ireland, okay, for everything. 60 doctors. That's the equivalent of what the provision is in Malawi right now, 60 doctors. Some health ministers will be going, this is great, get rid of them all. Would soon sort the place out. But I think 60 is almost certainly too few. What does that look like in terms of places? In 1991, 20 students per year. Since 2016 or so, it's been up to about 100 students a year. I was dean when we went up to those sorts of numbers, and it's gradually getting a bit slower, a bit higher. That's the equivalent of 11 places a year in Northern Ireland. So I don't know if we could count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, you guys get to go to med school. Sorry. But this is it. This is the entire quotient of people who are going to medical school this year in Malawi. It's 11 students. If we had to divide them up between QUB and UU, we get 8 and UU gets 3. Okay. it's that sort of numbers. Okay, tiny, tiny numbers relatively for the country. So that's the why. Because countries need doctors. Doctors are part of health system strengthening, and Malawi was very low on that. I also enjoyed teaching medical students. Not all medical students would say the same thing in reverse, but I did enjoy teaching medical students. So that's the why. What about the what? Well, you can imagine some of the what. And if my first what is this, what are the challenges? And I'm going to name a number here. What are the challenges? And you can imagine some of them. The first one is obviously cost. It costs a lot of money to train a doctor. It's been estimated in Malawi it's about $48,000. That sort of fits in with data that come from other studies as well. You can't really see the table very well. I obscured it deliberately. But it's from that Lancet series as well. It's about $50,000 on average in Africa to train a doctor. In Malawi, the gross national income per capita is $550 per annum. That's how much money the country makes. In the UK, it's about $42,000 per annum. The health spend in Malawi per annum is $38. The health spend in Malawi in the UK is $4,315. That's World Bank data that was just I looked at late last night. So training expensive people is a big ask. That's a big issue, a big thing to think about. We're going to train 100 of those people. That's an awful lot of money to put in to the system. So the cost and the challenges that go along with that are huge. There's pressures on faculty. The College of Medicine had a staff of about 147 between all of its different areas, and that gives a staff student ratio of about 1 in 14. That isn't too bad, actually. That's actually quite good for many parts of Africa. Most were running at about 1 in 20. But most of those academics are double jobbing. They're not getting very much for their job from the College of Medicine. I had the odd position in my last year in Malawi of being asked by Queen's would I be interested in coming back and working here, and I said yes and had interviews and and to sort of hook me on, they offered me a 0.1 appointment post, which was great. So I got a 0.1 role, whole time equivalent role, for my last year in Malawi, and I was an honorary lecturer and and that worked out nicely. That 0.1 of a whole time equivalent post was almost double my Malawi salary for what it was. It was so many people in the college are struggling and double jobbing in private work or running their own businesses, etc. And the clinical burden is high and it takes its toll on people. So there's pressures on faculty. There's obviously pressures on infrastructures, you would imagine. Again, these are some of the same data from that same study. But it sort of says, you know, there isn't enough buildings, there isn't enough teaching space, there isn't enough IT, there isn't enough whatever, you know, name it what it is. We do not have enough of space. Now, all medical schools say this, you know, I'm responsible for the medical school here. And if I ever meet anybody in the Department of Health, I'll tell them all the long list of things that we do not have. That's my job. But there really isn't an awful lot of infrastructure to go around. And that sounds okay, you sort of expect that, but I thought I'd actually get you to see what that looks like and perhaps what it feels like a little bit. Now, I'm going to show you a video from a red nose thing, and I have to say I'm going to apologize for this in some ways. It's the best video I've seen of what it feels like to look and work in an extremely long way. It's where we teach our third year students. And red nose people don't make videos like this anymore because it sort of looks like the white savior. In this case, it's Peter Capaldi who's turned up to talk about what's happening. But it's a good report because it's a very factual report, this one. It's not sort of, you know, doom and gloom and here's how we all fixed it. It's not easy watch. OK, so with that in mind, let me show you what it's like to be on a ward in Malawi in paediatrics in the rainy season, in a place where we put third year medical students, okay?
There's something I want to share with you, and it's good news. This is Lucy and her little boy, born just 2 days ago. Doesn't even have a name yet. Partly because of your donations to Comet Relief, he's been born into a country where mosquito nets are being made available to more and more families and are saving lives every day. Because of vaccines you are helping fund for children, the mortality rate has been dramatically reduced. But we're not quite there yet.
I went to the main hospital in Lilongwe, Malawi's capital, to see what still needs to be done. I met Jean, a nurse in the children's ward.
It's nice to see you, Jean. Thanks for letting us come. So how many kids do we have here on this bed?
We have 5 kids on this bed, and most of the kids here have been treated for malaria. Majority of these women don't have the mosquito nets.
And mosquito nets could have prevented the kids from getting malaria.
Yeah.
The ward is overrun with cases of malaria.
So there are 2 floors to this hospital, because it's not only busy on this floor, it's also busy on this floor.
There just simply aren't enough beds to go around. There are too many cases to fit these beds, so people have to sit on the floor and do whatever they can to look after their children.
A new case has been admitted. It's a little boy called Timbani. He's finding it hard to breathe. His mum and dad, along with his baby brother, have travelled for over 4 hours to get him to hospital.
He was admitted with complaint of chest pains, coughing, and shortness of breath. That child is very sick and has got a very severe disease.
Timbani Timbani has also tested positive for malaria, and it's devastating news for his mum. Timbani's mum has been in this situation before. Even before Timbani was born, she lost a son. He was an infant too, the same age as Timbani is now. It's vital that Timbani's breathing is stabilized, but there's not enough oxygen pumps to go around, so the only option now is to pump air into Timbani's body by hand. But there aren't enough medical staff, so it's up to Timbani's dad to help keep his son alive. All through the night, desperate to see any sign of recovery, Timbani's dad hand pumped oxygen for his little boy. Timbani had become too weak to cope, and he went into cardiac arrest.
So that ward, and I know, like Charlie, you will have worked on that ward and seen what that looks like. That ward is a pretty busy ward. In many hospitals in Malawi, that would seem like a well-equipped ward. We would see, and that hospital could sometimes have days when 6-10 children would die in a regular day. That would not be an uncommon experience. Some days you'd only have 2 or 3, or fantastic day, you'd have none. But that's the sort of experience where many of our students are. In fact, I missed Peter Capaldi, but this is me in that same ward, teaching clinical officers some cardiology a few days later on that same ward, that this sink doesn't work at that day. We had no water into the ward that day. You're running a hospital and trying to treat people without running water into your hospital. So the challenges are amazing. The challenges of the two worlds, of the nice, shiny, sort of nice building where you could go and retreat sometimes, but the clinical world and the clinical reality that you faced of having to work in a very, very taxing environment was challenging. So that's challenges which you can all anticipate and imagine for all of us this year, particularly if you've been involved in some of the COVID stuff, to know how difficult that has been. Workforce planning is a challenge. Our interns, when they qualify in their house jobs, they do an 18-month internship. They work in really busy places. Each intern will probably clerk about 40 people a day as paediatrics. When they're doing their cesarean, when they're doing obs and gyne, they'll be doing 4 or 5 C-sections on their own, in the equivalent of an F1 doctor, 6 weeks into their foundation job. They'll be 1 in 4 with 24-hour on-call for those 18 months. They're an eager bunch. The year before I left Malawi, 51 of them weren't offered an internship position by the department, by the Ministry of Health, because there was no money for them. So they were trained, and 50 doctors weren't able to enter the workforce. 48 of them did it for free, which was impressive. But they went on and then eventually did get that. But the issues of workforce planning, and when money is, when you're running from hand to mouth as a country and you cannot get the income and the expenditure to line up properly, and I'm not, this is not to blame a country, you know, officials in Malawi who work incredibly hard to make those squares circles or circles square, but it's very challenging when you're that doctor and you would like to work and nobody's going to pay you. And then the question, I guess many of you are even thinking, well, what does that do? Does that cause people to leave? Do they leave? What about the brain drain that's much talked about? It's been studied at some length, actually, and these are data, again, from a similar paper in The Lancet looking at outcomes for doctors from sub-Saharan Africa. And actually, The good news is about 5 years out, only about 20% of them have left. The rest of them are still in their home country, but they're working mainly in urban areas. They're not working in the rural spots. Urban specialist practice, urban general practice, urban private practice, but very few working in rural areas. Remember, 80% of the population, rural areas. 9% of the doctors in those rural areas. Most of the doctors in the cities, and some of the doctors have left. And Malawi, again, nice study done where they followed up 5 years worth of doctors and actually then followed them up for 5 years afterwards. So we've got pretty good numbers on what how Malawi's follow-up on the brain drain is. Of those, 5 years after graduation, 80% of them were still in the country. But the odds ratio of immigration, the odds risk of immigration, doubled for every year after that. So the further you were away from graduation, the more likely you were to leave the country. And of the ones who had left the country, 37 of that group had left the country. Actually, 80% of them were there, 60% were there training in South Africa under a College of Medicine sort of sandwich program, postgraduate training program. And I'll come back to that because that's actually a very good way of retaining people in your country. More than 80% of the graduates were working in the public sector, which is great. But again, the odds ratio of that declined by 27% for every year after graduation. So every year, about another 20% moved from the public into the private or the internal brain drain. So the question is really, not do you want to go and work in America or the US? Some do. The pool of those is lovely, but it's hard to get to do that. Home is a, people like to work at home, don't they? But the question is, do you want to work in a ward that looks like that? Or do you want to work in a nice, nice, comfortable office? This is Uganda. This is Makerere. That was the first hospital picture there of Makerere. Or work in the Infectious Diseases Institute, which is right beside this in Kampala. Lovely, funded organization with tons of money coming in from outside. You only see a few patients a day. You're doing nice studies. It's a nice place to work. It's good work. It's important work. But somebody needs to work there too. And how do we shift that balance? And the issue is really that the external brain drain has been reduced by good local postgraduate training has stopped people or reduced the numbers of people leaving. But the internal brain drain is a lot more challenging. And that's going to involve salaries. It's the hard stuff of salaries and making sure working conditions are equal and equitable and actually market forces the numbers of doctors coming through. So that's the what. What are the challenges? Some of you are medical educators and you'd be saying, well, what do you actually teach? How do you do it? So the second what is, what's the course content? What does it look like? And I would like to say it looks nothing like C25, but I might be lying. Okay. I'll show it up here. The first couple of years are a series of mainly in lecture theatre or small tutorial systems-based courses looking at foundations, musculoskeletal, cardiovascular, respiratory, then gastroenterology, endocrine, neuroscience. Actually, it's almost the same order as we do it in Queen's as well. But it's very little clinical contact. I started clinical skills training when I was in Malawi. I mean, I started got the lab up and running, started getting people in because we weren't doing any clinical skills in first and second year. Then they do a third, fourth and fifth year, which is nearly rotations. The third year is in Lilongwe. The third year is in that hospital I showed you pictures of. And they do pediatrics, medicine, surgery in blocks for about 8 weeks. And they do a community health block as well, where they are working with the public health agencies in Malawi. There's some extra wee bits and pieces in there of research methods. In fourth year, they're doing obs and gyne for their first rotation. Family medicine, which is a bit like general practice, but more secondary care general practice, if that makes sense. Mental health and a research project with little bits of anaesthesia, dermatology, ophthalmology and A&E. And then in final year, they get senior rotations in pediatrics, medicine, obs and gyne and surgery. And the striking thing you'll see there is obviously they spend a lot more time in obs and gyne and in pediatrics than students in European or Australian or North American medical schools do. And that's obvious. Half the population is under 15, and it has some of the highest maternal mortality ratios in the world. So those are the needs are. So they spend a lot of time doing that. Less ologies, more public health, more hands-on. It's community-based in some places. One of the lovely things we do with our students in the first couple of weeks is we would send them to live in a village for a week. They would go with their duvets and their nice pink fluffy stuff and their little iPods and everything, and they would be put in a village where they would have to sleep on the floor, get water out of a borehole, whatever. I'm trying to think of an equivalent of this in Northern Ireland, but I don't want to say where it would be because I'm going to offend somebody, I'm sure. But this, it's the equivalent of making them go and live somewhere with the rural poor for at least a week. So quite an eye-opener. The emphasis is, one of the things I've struggled with, is the emphasis is much more about coverage than it is about patient safety. Patient safety is on the agenda, but it's not that much on the agenda. It's about how can we provide the best care for the most people and do it effectively. And patient safety comes into that, but it's not the same emphasis. And I say this to my own shame. Students are overassessed. There's an old-fashioned idea that you must assess people all the time and sort of beat them with it. And they are under-supported, very much under-supported. Nice people working there, but students like this, seeing young people, seeing really dreadful things and not given the support around that they need. And we were very early doors in trying to provide some of that. Students get that their own way, the same way medical students get everywhere. Medical students like free food. This was free food provided in my garden, so medical students like that sort of stuff. But it's a very spiritual sort of country. People like to gather together to pray and to sing. There's no issue with that. There's no sort of distinction or this is a secular part of my life and this is a sort of spiritual part of my life. People mix those things up with abandon. You know, it's no problem at all. And these are some of our students praying with patients on the ward, doing something together to help themselves keep body and soul together. We have some remarkably good bits. This is our curriculum management system for first and second year. It was brought in from the University of St Andrews, who helped us with it. This is the weekly timetable online with all the different, they're sort of doing their integrated renal bit here, and they've got the different things that they're doing, lectures and tutorials. Here's some clinical skills down here. And if you clicked on one of those things, it would take you to the lecture, which has got the notes up there and some learning outcomes and links through. So it's a very nice sort of curriculum management system that we've got. And I managed to do, when I first came here, I'd managed to do an online finals in Malawi and on MCQs in 2015, which was excellent. We marked it online, got all of our reliability indexes and things, arrived here in Northern Ireland and found it was on paper and thought, wow, this is good. This is good. But I know Seamus was at it, so it was great. So again, what are they doing? It's incredibly practical. 8 weeks in paediatrics in their senior block. And they're spending daily 3 hours in the ward round, easily on the ward round. The ward round they're often doing on their own. They're going and seeing patients and coming and reporting back to us. I'll give them a bay of patients to look after and they'll come and tell me what they're doing. 20 lectures, 5 bedside teachings during that. They'll clerk over 50 patients easily, 4 long write-ups that they have to send into us. They'll do a minimum of 5 lumbar punctures. I mean, a minimum of 5 lumbar punctures in children. They'll be teaching third year students how to do lumbar punctures. They'll be putting IVs in, 7 on calls where they're staying until midnight. They'll have an OSCE and a written and a continuous assessment part of that 8-week block. This is part of the over assessment that they had, and that must be passed for them to pass the year. And in that, 2 or 3 kids are dying a day. Really, really, really sick children that they're seeing. But remarkable people. Because Seamus is the chair, I thought I have to do something about assessment. So what do we teach and what do we assess? Well, we do OSCEs, and we started OSCEs when I was there. We got systematic OSCEs there with sort of standard sorts of things and standard marking sheets, etc. We did OSCEs with communication skills here, resuscitation skills. This is a student about to go in and see a patient. We often had some things on video. We had lots and lots of places where you could put things on video. And for example, you might be a picture of a dehydrated child. They see some of that, and the examiner's asking them some questions. You know, it's a dehydrated child. They can see the dehydrated child. They have to then say, well, this is a dehydrated child. Write a note about it in their OSCE, and they're asked then by the examiner, well, what fluid are you going to give a dehydrated child? Who is, and they could see that they're malnourished and not in shock, and they would have to know that they should give, well, Resomal rather than standard oral rehydration solution because it's got more potassium and less sodium. And they should know that they should give that nasogastrically, and they should know that they should give 5 mL/kg every 30 minutes. These are WHO criteria and protocols that we are teaching our students, which look nothing like fluid resuscitation here. It's a whole different world. A shocked, severely dehydrated child in Malawi gets 100 mL/kg of fluid. If you're a pediatrician, you're going, what? At this point, it is big numbers of fluid, again, covering WHO. Here's a nice little example. Toddler's brought the, there's an MCQ. Toddler's brought the hospital because he's lost consciousness. Sorry, it didn't pass the MCQ test, Seamus, so forgive me. His grandmother's terminal cancer, been treated at home with MST. You can get that in Malawi, slow-release morphine tablets. The family have recently dusted their maize with pesticides. That doesn't happen very often in Northern Ireland. Which of the following features would make you think he's been poisoned with organophosphates rather than morphine? Because organophosphate poisoning with maize pesticide was the commonest form of poisoning that people would present with. And of all those five answers, the only one which stands out differently is hypersalivation, and they would get atropine. It looks a bit like having a Novichok, actually. It's very similar. You're getting one of those nerve agents. You just have to hammer people with atropine. You admit that this would definitely fail the test. You 20-year-old man with malaria. Which one of the following features would not be an indication? Sorry, I know it's people, Seamus is grinding his teeth, for IV or tucinate therapy. This is testing what are the serious malaria syndromes. Acidemia is one, hemoglobinuria is one, hyperlactatemia is one, hyperparasitemia is one, but hypoglycemia is not one. It's a dreadful MCQ question, but it's getting at what we're trying to teach. Likewise, you know, match the antiretroviral drug. Is it a fusion inhibitor? Is it a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor? Is it an integrase inhibitor? Our students pass a 7-day long course in HIV prescribing, right through to really significant drugs that they're prescribing day one when they come out of medical school. So that's the second what. It's a big practical course. And what does it look like? It looks like when you're on call and you see your on call, and you go to the up to the A&E department, and you see somebody who has just come out of medical school a week beforehand and asks you, would you see somebody? And I'll go, yeah, I'll come and see somebody. And she's admitted a 2-year-old child. And they said, yeah, okay, well, what have you done? Well, this child was fitting Dr. Kennedy on arrival. Okay, convulsing, great. So I checked the blood sugar. The blood sugar was 2. I gave an IV dextrose bolus. I got a line in. I checked the hemoglobin. The hemoglobin is 4. I've got blood on order. There's 4 pluses of paracetamol. I've started phenobarbitone. The child's blood sugar has then risen. It's now started convulsing again. I think he's got cerebral malaria. I've given an IV phenobarbitone dose. I've got a nasogastric tube in, and the child's on oxygen. That's a 22-year-old doctor has done that a week or two out of medical school. That's the level of practical skill that these individuals have. That's very different from our world, isn't it? If you scrape below that, you will not find maybe the same rigor of biomedical sciences or the same nuances about communication or about professional behavior. But my goodness, do they know what they're doing in terms of providing a good thing. And that brings me on to, finally, as you'd be glad to hear, my second why. Okay, so we've had aware, 2 what's, 1 why about medical education. This is my second why, and the second why is all about one person. And this is a guy called Kondwani's Gambo. It's a very bad picture of Kondwani there. It's fair to say Kondwani was not a high flyer in our medical school. He was sort of about 6th, 7th decile equivalent of our medical school. Kondwani's a doctor in the place where I used to be a mission hospital doctor now. He's in charge of that hospital. I trained him as a medical student. He is so much better at being the medical officer in charge of that hospital than I ever was. He's excellent clinically. He's actually really good. He's also just really good because he knows the language. He's from there. He knows people. He's able to integrate teams. He's a really good selfie taker. This is him. He gets teams together. This is him with his, sort of, some clinical officers and nurses and stuff that he's got. He likes to jump about and things. And he came to talk to me before he went off to work there. And he said, Neil, what do you think we should be doing? And I talked to him about some of the budgeting issues and some of the building issues we had and some of the things I knew he would struggle with personalities in that particular area. And I was trying to sort of management speak him about this sort of stuff. And of course, he ignored all of that and got there and organized a prayer meeting instead and took everybody up the mountain and prayed because he saw that that's what they needed and realized that in Malawi, that's actually incredibly appropriate. He built a team by taking people up a mountain and getting them to pray for 6 hours on top of a mountain and sing, okay? I've never seen that done in the NHS, not knowingly, okay? And he's done it every year since. And that teamwork that he's built has resulted in a transformation of the hospital with a lot nice new building, a lot of investment from donors. He's a very donor-friendly sort of guy. This is him with the Minister of Health showing him around. This is him on TV in Malawi talking about rural medicine, about the need for people to work in rural areas and how this is a calling for him. And then lastly, this is a picture of him with two Malawian medical students because he's got a scheme going now where people can come and do their summer holidays in the mission hospital and they can work with him. And he's had about 40 of them through over the last few years. I put up a quote here about this, the why. This is our why here from Queen's. It's the same why. It's the same why that gets me now. Still, I think we all are in Queen's wanting to train medical graduates who are caring and compassionate, who are problem solvers, reflective practitioners with excellent clinical skills, who above all else serve their patients. And for me, that's a why here. It was a big why in Malawi too, and Kondwani was a person who exemplified that for me. So thanks for your attention.
Neil, thank you very much. I'll go around with it so that people at home can hear me. You might see the chat now on the Teams. Thank you very much, Neil. I'll keep it this down. Thank you very much, Neil. The people at home now, the people who are sitting in their chair with a cup of coffee in their hand, now have to earn their keep by sending us in some questions. You can either do that by unmuting yourself and speaking or raising your hand, or you can simply type in the chat. Jerry, you have a question for us here in the audience.
Neil, what a fascinating talk. It really was very insightful and really challenging in many different levels. But can I ask you, do you miss it personally?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So the question is, do I miss it personally? Not every day now, but 2 or 3 days a week. I will look at something, memories of it all the place. And often actually because of chatting to my children or something else. It's a brilliant, it may look like, don't get any sort of sense of sort of sacrifice out of this, Jared. I loved working there. It was a real haul to come back here. I love working here too, but I was like the round peg for the round hole, and not everybody is.
You mentioned, touched a little bit on moral distress, and it's been a very thematic issue over the last couple of years of COVID. I mean, how did you manage moral distress personally, and how did you get medical students to cope with that in that context?
Well, I don't think I did very well. There's a question about handling moral distress personally and helping medical students do it. I have to say, I don't think I did that very well with medical students. I could have done better, and we should have done better. And I worked with some of the spiritual and faith groups. Again, in the medical school, there's all sorts of faith groups. And the principal, who was my boss, said sometimes he had to go around the lecture theatres and tell them to stop singing in tongues because it was just annoying the lecture next door. Again, things that I don't see happening in Queens. So that helps. But personally, how did I reconcile it? I think the first time I was there, it was really hard, actually. Those 2 or 3 years in, I was finding it really quite challenging. And it was, how you do it, you listen to Malawians because they're facing it all the time and you learn from them about how they do it. And they do it through quiet reflection by talking to their colleagues about it, but actually a bigger sense of, and this will reflect my own faith experience there, a bigger sense of what the world is, that the world is not just what you see, that the world is beyond that and that there is something beyond this and it doesn't just end here. And there is a sense of acceptance and acceptance, not a fate or fatalism, but a sense of there's bigger purposes here. And that provides great strength and comfort for many people. Malawians would, if you're grieving, you just sit with people. That's what you do. You just sit beside them. You don't talk. You just sit. And you just wait and you just let it all hang. And then you grieve in spades with lots of crying, but you just sit with people and watch. And doing those things for me helped actually a lot. And when we came back to Malawi in 2008, I found it much less challenging. There's still days when I went home and cried and hugged my kids a lot more than I did, but much less than I'd done before because I got, in a sense, used to that. It's still dreadful telling, you know, your days in A&E, some days when they would put a baby in front of you, you resuscitate the baby. It didn't work. You'd take the baby, literally the dead body off, and you would be talking to the mum and handing her her dead child, and maybe putting somebody in front of you to start resuscitating again. And you've no time to talk to that individual. So it is hard.
Okay, thank you very much. There's a question on the chat. Was there any emotional support for the students?
The support, that's Jim. The support, Jim, was through each other and then through talking to senior staff. So they would see that. And, I think role modelling is so important in any aspect of medicine. And where they saw good role models, the students would gravitate to that and you could see it much more obviously. And that's where they would gain support. And they would gain support from talking to each other, praying with each other, going out in the town the odd time and doing those sorts of things. But that's how they would gain their support. But I have to say, Jim, it wasn't enough and we needed to do it better.
Okay. Next then, I see Nigel Hart, our president-elect for Ulster Medical Society, has his hand raised. Do you want to unmute Nigel and ask your question?
Thanks very much, Seamus, and thank you, Neil, for that fantastic talk. I'm speaking this question because it's hard to put actually to write it all down. But over the last couple of years, particularly with your leadership through COVID, there's times when it seemed absolutely just, you know, we were underwater and really struggling. And I often looked at you and sort of thought, because you seem to be just working through it. And it often occurred to me that the training that you got in Malawi, the experience you had in Malawi, was a thing which helped you just realize that, you know, you just got to keep on working through. And is it fair to say that your ability to kind of rise above the crisis comes from the time you have spent in Malawi?
Just so the audience can hear that, Nigel's asking whether Neil's ability to weather the storms and his resilience comes from his time training in resilience in Malawi.
Yeah, and I think that's true. The other way of looking at that is I just don't know what's going on and I'm just oblivious to the problems. Happily unconcerned, you know. but no, I think you're right, Nigel, it is. In fact, I showed one of those slides in my interview. I was being interviewed to become acting director and the GMC were coming a week later or a month later. And I said, you know, if I can teach medical students in a place where there's no water and this is sort of what's happening, I think I can cope with some of the challenges you're going to throw at me. And that doesn't mean I have to say this last 18 months has actually been in many ways more challenging, especially the first year of it was probably more challenging than many of the times I had in Malawi. It was uniquely challenging because of the state of flux we had. In Malawi, it's steadily bad. Steady bad is okay. Up and down terrible is awful to deal with. The uncertainty has been very difficult, hasn't it? Uniquely challenging. But yeah, I do think it's given me some extra skin to deal with.
There's a sister question there from Michael Williams about how did you find the adjustment back to the affluence and the expectations of Northern Ireland? Is there anything affluence in Northern Ireland?
Yeah. So, Michael, I think that's a good question. We were coming backwards and forwards. But the first time we lived in Malawi, it was a huge change because we were often in this rural area for often years at a time, and then we'd come out, and it was chalk and cheese. I remember Sarah coming back, and we went to Tesco's in Knocknagoni. It hadn't been built when we left. We came back to this warehouse-sized shop, and I said, "Oh my word!" And we took two trolleys, and I went to one end, and she started on the other. I met her on the first row. I'd gone up and down all the other ones. She was just stuck on the first row. She couldn't choose. She didn't know which one of the many things to choose. But then over the years, we were coming backwards and forwards, and we learned to live in the two worlds. We learned to sort of, you know, and I know people in the audience here, you learn to do that. You learn to sort of leave it and walk into a new one. And you have to cross that bridge backwards and forwards. And the expectations of here, I loved having colleagues. What was one of the best things, even my Queen's colleagues have been great. I've loved having people around me and having people to bounce ideas off, and that sense of security and other people to talk things through with. That's been just tremendous. I've loved that. I have missed some of the tremendous things we've got in Malawi. But one of the things I was concerned about, in Malawi, we've changed an awful lot. When things are so bad, little bits of change produce massive good. And you get used to that. You get a change. You become a bit of a change junkie. And I was concerned when I arrived here that Northern Ireland would be a conservative with a small C place when it came to medical school life. I have to say, I've been really pleasantly surprised. I don't think we're dyed-in-the-wool liberals, but we aren't that conservative. You know, we have changed enormous amounts of things in our medical school. I think for the better, I would say that. But I think that's been positive, and it's been good. So, yeah, adjustments both ways, Michael.
I think that's nearly all the questions, unless there's any other in the audience.
Mon from Monica. But...
Thanks, Nelly. Modest as ever. You talked about, when you were talking about the curriculum in Malawi, the changes that required were huge. Developing countries generally, in Malawi in particular, suffers from very, very low income for dental service, very dependent on external international development partners.
Yeah.
There's a lot of naysaying, there's a lot of it's just too difficult, let's not bother. To what extent were you able to apply your own experience when you came home and started working on the curriculum here?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think I cut my medical education and change management teeth in Malawi. I saw people who didn't want to do anything different, found it too difficult, it was too many bigger problems. But there were so many people in Malawi, and you know, Malawians, I mean, who were saying, well, it doesn't need to be like this. We can change things, and we can fix things, and we can move things on. And some of my colleagues that I trained, or some of the colleagues I worked with, I don't know if you know Queen Dubé, but she's one of my paediatric colleagues. She became a consultant when I was there. Queen is now working with WHO on maternal and child health. She's got a $27 million budget thing that she's transforming neonatal care in Malawi and Tanzania and Nigeria. It's really impressive work, hugely life-changing. So I saw examples of people who weren't prepared to say, doesn't always need to be like this, but it's about picking your battles, I think, isn't it? So, and not picking every battle, because you picked every battle, you were going to be in big, big trouble. And that was the cleverness was working out what's the, and that's the same with any leader, I think, and any leadership is knowing which ones, when's it time, and what should, and what's the strategic areas to change. If you can do that right, you're on a bit of a winner. And I don't think I've got all that right all the time here, but I did learn a lot in Malawi about when to look for such moments.
Thank you, Professor Kennedy, for your talking as well as that. I have a question about elective. For fear, is the College of Medicine in Malawi accepting Queen's Medical students?
Yep.
If so, would you recommend it?
I would. We had a fantastic elective arrangement there. We had, just in fact, the year when COVID struck, we were going to have 17 students from Queen's going to Malawi, which was actually, I was a bit worried about that. I thought that's actually maybe too many. But we frequently had 5 to 10 going. It's a good place, and I was able to make connections, which you could make sure that somebody at the other end was going to look after you, and you know, so we had a number of nice arrangements there. So if possibly one day we're allowed to do overseas electives again, I'm hoping that Malawi will be back on the circuit again. It's Malawi is Africa for beginners. Speaks English. It's a poor country, but it's a stable, poor country. People should be fighting about all sorts of stuff. They don't fight enough, really. They're far too calm and nice, and it's peaceful. It's a lovely, beautiful place to be. So, you know, it's a good country for people to go to, relatively safe as well.
Right. Yeah. On that final note from Malawi Tourist Board.
Indeed, yeah.
Thank you very much, Neil. A small token from the
office. Thanks, thank you. That's very appreciation. Thank you. Thank you,
Mr. And applause, please, for the...